Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you too.
And each and every night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Michael Hallmeyer back with us. It is the It's the Law segment of the Dresser After Dark. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Michael, when we look at what's going on today, I want to go to bed and I want to hide and I don't want to get up for another maybe a year and a half. I don't quite understand what's going on in the world today. And with all due respect, and we've discussed this before, there are attorneys I love, and there are attorneys who are attorneys that for some reason that they're the people running the government, and they shouldn't be there because they don't have that savvy, that wisdom of somebody who's been out there and knows how to run a business. And that's what the government has become, cash in, cash out business.
It's really sad, and it's even worse than that. Not only are people enriching themselves at the expense of the rest of the folks, but the rest of the folks are prohibited from enriching themselves through getting the result of their own hard work. It's just not right on both of those grounds.
No, no question about it. There was something that came through today, and I'll shoot it to you sometime during the week, but it's the they've just uncovered taxpayer dollars going to create internet exposure to some of the Middle Eastern countries where there are terrorists there. We have people starving here. We have people losing their homes, and we are giving billions of dollars away. The other thing is, if we're going to pull out of Afghanistan, that's one thing. But I have to take a look at it through these eyes. During the Second World War, thank goodness he did this, by the way, Hitler didn't let his generals run the war. He took the power away, had no idea what he was doing, and that in and of itself cost him the war. Now we're going to pull out of Afghanistan. Instead of going to Petraeus to say, what's your take on this? Which is the way to go? The president hands it to someone else who does not have the wherewithal. I'm getting concerned that most of this, and we've touched on this before, Michael, that most of this has got to be intentional. You can't be this stupid.
You really can't, but it seems every day we're facing another situation, another story that you have to scratch your head and say, if it's not stupidity and you just don't buy that from these people because they are smart, it must be that they intend to do the harm. They don't see us as special, and they want us just another country in the herd of countries around the world. We don't belong there. Everybody knows better than that. And I think the poll numbers reflect that, although I rather suspect the poll numbers are inaccurate in that they don't actually depict how many people are truly unhappy with this administration.
No, absolutely. You mentioned early on when we first started, you said something to the effect of there are a select few, I'll say it in my words, a select few, that are making money while everybody else isn't. I'll give you the example of Nancy Pelosi, and I'm sure you heard it. Her income increased 65% in the last year.
Yeah, it's shocking, and it drives me to distraction. And all the people, my firm's a small business law firm, and we work with middle-class people, small and medium-sized businesses and startups. We're not a big firm charging mega bucks to only the big corporate clients. So really, our bread and butter, day in and day out, is working with smaller businesses, new businesses, medium-sized businesses. These are the businesses that are the economic engine of this country. Those folks are struggling. The government is making not only not making it easier, it's affirmatively making it harder on them. These are the people who are going to hire us out of this recession. If they were only given the freedom, if the burden of regulation and taxation and uncertainty was lifted from their shoulders, these people would step up as they have always done through the history of this country and provide the answer that we're looking for. The answer isn't going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from inside the Beltway. It's not going to come from the elites of both political parties. It's going to come from the middle class owned businesses in this country that are going to put this country back to work. And the sooner that we can get government out of people's way so that they can do that, the sooner not only will my clients and my own business, my own practice, do better, but this country will return as well.
See, the bigger concern, and not the bigger, but as big a concern is that, you know, they're fighting about taxes now when we've got, you know, the Republicans walking off the committee because they don't want anybody taxed anymore. So if you tax people, if you tax us down to a point where we can't afford anything, and by the way, don't let me forget to mention gasoline also. If you tax us to a point where we can't afford to live, and yet at the same time, there are people in government living the lush life. Our president is living a lush life. If he's going to live it, I would venture to guess, and I know this is a horrible thing I'm going to say, if you're going to do it, hide. Do not throw it in everybody's face while you've got, again, people losing homes, losing jobs. The unemployment rate has gone up again, and nobody sees any clarity to anything that's going to happen. Now, I 32 million, I forgot what the number was. There's an amount of gas that the president is going to, from our reserves, is going to open up to the public. Okay, well, that's well good. Where does it get replaced? And what I'm concerned about is just to make everything look good, he opens it up, and pretty soon we don't have a reserve. What do you do to replace that?
There are two points about what you're raising, both of them extremely important. I mean extremely important. The one is, this is an administration that likes to make these sweeping gestures that have absolutely no effect on a long-term basis. Selling 30 million barrels of oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is going to have a momentary effect on price, and then it will go away, as did the cash for clunkers go away with car sales. These momentary fixes, these quick fixes, do not last, and they're a total waste. But again, as you point out, once you do the quick fix, when the dust settles, you're in a worse position than you were in before. Maybe the reserve will be depleted. And, you know, it was never intended to be something that would affect short-term pricing of gasoline supplies. It was there as a strategic reserve. Strategic meaning, if some foreign nation or association of nations like OPEC was trying to bankrupt this country into making decisions other than the ones it thought were the right decisions on a foreign policy level that it ought to take, such as support for our stalwart ally of Israel, we'd be able to withstand that kind of pressure because we had this short-term reserve. That reserve can be gone in a very short period of time if it's piddled away like this. And also, you're not going to affect prices on a long-term basis. So why is he doing it if everybody can tell him it will not only have no positive effect, it will actually have a negative effect? You got to figure the guy doesn't mean us well.
No, but the key here is this, and I don't want to keep harping on it, but it's almost as if I have to. We're dealing with somebody who he's an attorney. He is academic. He's not stupid. And at the same time, look at some of the things that are going on. And if this isn't intentional, Michael, I don't know what is. And I you know me well enough to know that I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a pragmatist. And when I take a look at things and I break it down and I look at the potential consequence of what's going on, this is intentional. You separate. If you want to destroy us, you separate us. Then what you do is you erode the economy. Then what you do is you nationalize everything. Then you've got the middle class that are dependent upon the government to eat. So now they're totally controlled. Now we want a quote unquote, we want a civilian military up there. And we want a civilian military that's going to be stronger than our external military, quote unquote, which would be loyal to the president. Now we see what goes on with Gaddafi. You got the government troops fighting the other troops. And it's going to be very interesting to see what goes on here. Little by little, we're not who we are anymore.
And the, you know, whether he's incompetent or maliciously minded, it kind of doesn't matter. The fix to both situations is to replace him next year. And so kind of the debate, although it's very interesting for you and me and hopefully a lot of the folks tuning in, really the fix is the same in either case. And I'm kind of mostly interested in the fix than exactly what the diagnosis is. I want to know what's the treatment. The treatment is, we desperately need a replacement in 2012.
Well, let me tell you what's happening, and I'm starting to see it more and more in the media. We have been so politically correct over the last 5-10 years that we literally destroyed ourselves. You can't say anything to anybody, anytime, anyhow, anywhere. Children in the 4th and 5th grade are learning about cross-gender and so on and so forth, and they're handing out condoms in the high schools, and youngsters, young girls, can go to a doctor, get an abortion, and their parents don't have to find out about it, yada, yada. The list goes on. And I really believe when it comes down to it, if we can get some leaders in there, we can get some business people in there, we can get some people with some logic in there. And I believe if you're going to do anything, it should be more of a fair tax. It's a pay-as-you-go. That way it brings it up from below the table. Nobody can hide any money, and nobody's going to be concerned about this one gets more than the other one. You pay as you go, and your income is your income.
That kind of a fix will do wonders to improve things, but obviously that kind of a fix is never going to be approved by the folks who are running the show right now. They need to be replaced. Time is short. The amount of damage that's been done in 2.5 years of this administration has been significant. I don't think we're over the cliff yet, but we're definitely hanging on by our fingernails, you know, and the time to fix things is now, and if not today, when? In 2012. It's got to happen then, and I think most of the people have a sense that, you know, we're absolutely right, and they're going to show up next year and make it happen. They have to.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with this and showing up next year and make it happen, I want to go back. I sidetracked myself regarding PC. We had to be so politically correct. We were concerned. If you said anything about the president, then you were a racist. If you said anything about women, you were this. And if you said anything about that, you know, you got stuck with the label and they buried you and you couldn't say anything because no matter what you did, you were wrong. Well, I think what I am seeing now, and I'm seeing it more and more, people are starting to step out of that. They're making their comments. They're coming, quote unquote, they're coming out of the closet, so to speak, whereby it's okay to stand up and say, you can't say that to me to control me. And that's really what it was. Speech has been used to control speech.
That's very true. We all saw this coming. Political correctness was billed as something other than what it was. We all knew that it was really going to be used as a mechanism to try to silence the opposition being the common sense majority of people in this country who are statistically to the right of center, the conservative people. That was its purpose, and that has been the way it has been yielded. And the only way, however, thank goodness, the only way that is successful in stifling the rest of us is if we allow it to be. We have to all step up and say, enough already, and we're going to do something about it, and not just say enough, but actually do enough already. And that only happens in elections. And the question we discussed a year and a half ago was whether folks would turn out in 2012 who were saying enough and really vote enough. And they did. And a huge sea change occurred. That needs to happen again. We're not done. If people aren't happy with the fact that, you know, junior high school kids can get abortions on demand, et cetera, all the stuff we talk about and say, Why do we allow this to happen? It's because we allow it to happen. We all have to stand up and say, not going to take it anymore. I'm mad, as you know, and I'm not taking it anymore. People did that. I don't think they're done. I think they're going to do it next year. That's the only way we take this country back.
I talked to somebody today in Southern California whose wife is has been working with the Tea Party, working with two or three different divisions of it, and yep. going. And so the movement is still there. And who and what is the Tea Party? The Tea Party were average American people who did not have a voice before, and now they have a voice. They're not racist. They're not bigots. They're not somebody who's going to go out and kill you. Take a look at the pictures of them. They're normal, everyday people running around, older people in shorts. These are not the ones that are dressed in combat. So, in essence, these are the people who are America. This stuff about, when was it, NBC taking God out of the pledge and so on and so forth. Where do they get off doing this? Where did they get off killing the pledge in and of itself? The pledge was to a flag. The flag is representative of every freedom that we have and everything we've ever been and done. Yes, there were some problems. Yeah.
The where they get off when we tell them to get off the bus, to get off this train they've got moving power away from us. If we let them, the way they get off, they stop doing that is because we make them. And the way that we have been able to mobilize ourselves has been through the alternative media. Your program, talk radio, the internet, blogging, these are all ways for the rest of us for whom the mainstream media refuses to speak or even allow us to be one of many voices. They don't let us in at all. Our voices have been heard and shared, and they resonate because of the alternative media and people like you. This technology is what has made the difference, and this technology is allowing us the opportunity, if we will take it, to take our country back. So far, so good, but we're not done yet. The tests will continue, and by the way, they won't end next year, assuming the election goes the way we hope and pray that it will. We're not done. Eternal vigilance is our duty, and we will constantly having to watch things once that election is over. And the only way we have a chance of continuing things on the right course is through media like yours.
And what we have to remember, that there's got to be T-shirts with signs on it that says, who works for who? And there's where the confusion has become. The politicians have begun to define, and I don't hate all politicians. It's not where I'm at with this. But there is a euphoria. There is this mindset that a lot of them get into, and the fact, I'll give you Pelosi. Don't worry about what it says. Just sign it. You'll find out afterwards. Who is she talking to? What kind of brainless individuals does she think she's talking to? These people that talk down to their constituents. They're not the constituents of the people who voted them in. They forget. Now the constituents are starting to stand up. Now we're going to see who works for who.
And that is why, yes, remember, they're called public servants. They work for us. But we have to be the voice. We have to tell them what to do. And if they stray, and when they stray, I guess it's inevitable, it seems, when they start tweeting photographs of themselves inappropriately, we need to step up and say, this is not allowable. And our voice gets heard and multiplied because we have the tools of the radio and the blog and the internet, programs such as yours. If it sounds glad-handing you, okay, maybe a little bit seriously, though, in all seriousness, this has been the technology that is allowing us to reassert our proper control under our system and gives us the hope that we can return things to a common sense plateau. We started last year. We got to continue it next year and then beyond. We can.
By the way, Michael, absolutely no question about that. And I think the real challenge is to keep up the diligence. You know, we've talked about this also. That if you get enough fear messages, you're going to get apathy. We've got to be able to move beyond the apathy. We've got to keep the spark running. And we need, you know, I got a feeling that somebody will vote for anybody as long as it's not Obama. That's not a good thing, because it doesn't mean that we're going to get the absolute best that's going to be there to represent us. So I'm still waiting for somebody to jump on. And so far, I like the guy from Texas, but we'll see what happens with that. Perry.
We will. It's going to be a very interesting. I have to tell you, despite the mainstream media saying we've got a bunch of clowns and bozos among the Republican candidates, I disagree. They may not all be the most photogenic or the most articulate, but I think almost any of them, almost any, is going to be an improvement over what we've got if only they apply a modicum of common sense and respect for our constitutional arrangement. If they bring that, and I think all of them will, they will at least be night and day improvement over what we have, and possibly even, can I dare say it, great.
Mm. Michael, we're out of time. Hey, a website we can find you at.
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, see you next week.
Look forward to it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night, Michael Ray.
It isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm
Caribbean. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Bark. Dark, where are we? Bark, it's a dog. Hey, Larry Kane up next.
Get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Larry Kane is with us. He's the author of Death by Deadline, a novel, the story of what could happen. What could happen when local TV news runs amok? He's the host of Voice of Reason on the Comcast Network, consultant Comcast Corporation, special contributor, KWY News Radio. He's known as the Dean of Philadelphia Television News Anchors. He's been one of the nation's most respected TV journalists for more than 43 years now. And let us say, Larry, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, way back when, years and years ago, I've been at this, 28 years now, and I know you've got some years on me, but we both go back far enough to realize that let's say the newspaper was a local newspaper. The radio was the local radio stations, and you knew who was on, et cetera. Then they got bought out for the most part, and that's when we lost touch. And realistically, today, there is a very thin line between news and entertainment, and the entertainment bleeds through, and sometimes, Larry, we get confused, and we're not sure which is which.
I think one of the issues that's very serious in America, that people have a hard time differentiating, not just between entertainment and news, but between entertainment politics and news.
Yeah.
For example, if you're watching a primetime television network, a CNN, Fox, or MSNBC, and you listen to a person with opinions and analysis, and a person's trying to motivate your thinking, you might think that you're getting straight news, but you're not. You're basically getting a lot of talk, a lot of opinion, and sometimes a lot of hearsay. So it's very difficult in today's media environment to differentiate between what is news and what is opinion. Someone will come up to me and say, you know, I heard on Hannity last night that, and I said, well, that's an opinion show. That's not a news program. It's much different.
Oh, big difference. As a matter of fact, every once in a while, we'll do politics on the show. I happen to be right to center. And everything that I say to a guest that is also in that area, it's opinion. What I am saying, I may have fact backing some of the things up, but for the most part, you're absolutely right. It's opinion, and people get confused between opinion and the factual activity that causes us to move the way we do.
Biggest challenge we have right now, though, is that 60% of Americans, this is going to frighten you, get their news, all their news from local news. That local news in America has dropped audience by 41% over the last 10 years because of its continual diet of the same old garbage. And that local newscasts are losing their appeal. I mean, that's almost two-thirds, more than one-third, about three-fifths of the people watching television going away. Where are they going? Well, they may be listening to you. They may be on the Internet. They may be on the cable news channels, but they're not going to local news. So local news stations, of which I've been a part of for almost 48 years, are basically fighting for a bigger piece of a much smaller pie. And the result is a lot of fluff, a lot of skin cream. An anchor went on the air the other night in this town, Philadelphia, with a headline that said, "We'll show you how to be bigger between the sheets."
Yeah,
and with no question what he was talking about there. And the fact is that when people don't have information, they can't judge and make judgments. And sometimes local newscast attempt to be first might wind up with them being wrong. Being first and wrong is deadly. Being second and right is ethical. And in this book, which is a murder mystery that hopefully will keep you up nights, I know it's kept a few of my friends up, where you never know what's going to happen next, where a washed-up anchor man, I'm the washed-up anchor, lays on a road trying to survive, goes through these hospitals trying to figure out what's going on. There are murders, there's debauchery, there's betrayal, there's corruption, there's good people, there's heroes, there's heroines, there's villains, and you basically are on a fly on the wall in the middle of three local television newsrooms.
By the way, love every second of that.
Some people will be shocked.
No, by the way, they love every second of that, because when you really come down to it, it's keeping that attention, that recognizable something that somebody sees, that they spot out there, that they recognize in their own life, that catches you up. One of the things, I want to go back to opinion for a moment. Years ago, I remember somebody walked into an office that I was in, and they watched soap operas. And I listened to the young woman talk to the secretary about the soap opera as if these people were real. Did you see what happened to so-and-so? I wonder what she's going to do about XYZ's husband, etc. And the problem is you're right. You get on the Hannity shows, you get on the Dan Suster, and you go to any one of the cable networks, and based on how much they like that host and whatever opinion is coming out, they're living what those people are saying. So reality to them at the moment is what's coming out of their favorite show. Because
absolutely. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with entertainment, and there's nothing wrong with soap operas. We don't really need soap operas anymore in America because we have them in Washington every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, who needs soaps when you got Anthony Weiner?
Yeah, in and of himself, I got that one loud and clear. But entertainment to whatever. But you're absolutely right. Who needs them? But at the same time, I watched, like him, dislike him, it really doesn't matter, but I watched two women that I know very closely, my sister and Radio Susie, who produces the show. She does all the magic here with that. Now, I saw both of those women, that man, glued to the television. Their eyes were open. Their mouths were dropped. They were totally tuned into what he was saying. And I walked in and I said something. They both, uh-huh. So it's hypnotic. It's mesmerizing. And I really believe that is scary, because the population right now, it doesn't go back as far as you and I go back, but it goes back to a point whereby the population wasn't as frightened as it is today about unknown conclusions. That is what I think is driving the country today with a tremendous amount of apathy. The unknown conclusions, the unknown. Now we go back to the book. If you keep me into the unknown, I want to know what's going to go on next. So you got me.
Well, you're never going to know in this book till the very end, but I will tell you one thing. I wanted to bring up something, if I have a moment here, that's kind of shocking about local news. We have a very partisan political situation in this country right now. It sort of reminds me of 1968. Everybody's being labeled one way or the other. Now, local news does not cover politics, period. They will cover ribbon cuttings or what we call silent video of a candidate moving his mouth or some ridiculous public spectacle, but they will not cover issues. At the same time, local television stations in this nation charge an absolute fortune for candidates to buy time. So what you're doing is you're forcing these candidates of each party, regardless of their persuasion, you're forcing them to spend a virtual fortune to get special interest involved because you're not covering the news.
Yeah.
And I venture to say, Michael, that if we in local TV news covered real issues about the environment, about education, about social issues, about overseas crises, real politics, then we wouldn't then candidates wouldn't have to pay as much to get on radio and television.
No, absolutely.
That to me is pathetic. That we and by the way, we also live in a country where only 55% of the eligible voters register to vote, and only 60% of them in a good election go to the polls. So 30% of our people are electing our nation. We have an uninformed, unactivated, little motivated nation where the media, which I love, and I love the First Amendment, I love the right to say what I feel, where the media, especially in local news, is not doing the job of informing people about candidates. We had four incredible congressional races here last year. Incredible races. Republicans and Democrats duking it out. I do a half-hour talk show on the weekends for Comcast, sort of my retirement program, if you can call it that. And we had all the candidates on. The five local TV stations in this market didn't cover them. They never covered them until election night. That's pathetic. But that's just one of the points of this. You're going to meet characters who are on the air and off the air that will astound you, like the woman who comes up to the anchor man in the newsroom and a story about the widow of a murdered civil rights leader and says, "Who was Malcolm the Tenth?"
Mm. Yeah.
And the editor says, "You mean Malcolm X?" She says, "No, who was Malcolm the Tenth? It's Roman numeral 10.
Yeah.
Or is Yom Kippur the Jewish Festival of Lights?" I mean, you know, you got a lot of ill-informed people out there.
That's control. Larry, that's absolute control. The media controls it. Politics controls it. And if I can frighten you enough, I'm going to cause you to move in a particular direction. If I can promise you something and you think that there's value in the promise, you're going to follow me. And my biggest concern in this country today, with all due respect, is that everything that we look for is being taken away. And those people who have nothing are promised something, and in the end result, they're ending up again with nothing. So we're living in a world of a lot of false promises and a lot of unknowns.
I'll tell you one thing about Death by Deadline. It's an e-book right now. It's available on all the e-platforms. There are no promises except one. You will be terrified. You will be enlightened. You will learn a lot about yourself and the people who give you the news. And you'll be heartened in somewhat by the fact that there are a few people out there still trying to do their jobs who care about the public. This is a story where TV news kills people. Literally, local TV news kills people with bad information.
And by the way, when we talk about bad information, and I think that's something we should touch on for a moment, and from the person delivering the information, as far as they're concerned, it's not bad information. And those people that are receiving the information, if it's sound, if it's logical enough, if it's given with enough emotional impact, they take it on. They end up believing.
No, I'm not talking about that, Michael. I'm not talking about opinion or analysis. I'm talking about a guy who walks out of a subway station in Philadelphia, who is a matching description of a killer, of a gang leader, young Latino guy who's a great kid. And he's arrested, and he's taken down to the police headquarters in Philadelphia, and he's let go because he's not the guy. Well, one of the reckless, slimy TV stations takes video of him walking out of this place. They run it at 4, 5, 6, and 11 o'clock. And the next day, this kid, who is not charged with anything because of his exposure unethically on television, is murdered in cold blood.
Okay, I hear you.
That's death. That's the mistakes I'm talking about. Or catastrophic information that might be released about the shooting, and this really happened, by the way, in Philadelphia, a young man shot and killed himself in the lobby of a high school 3 years ago in Springfield High School. Well, it turns out there are three Springfield High Schools in the Metro South Jersey, Delaware, Philadelphia area. The station that reported that three kids were murdered didn't even know he had killed himself. Three kids weren't murdered. They went on the air with bad information. They scared the hell out of the people who had the kids at all these schools. And they basically caused trauma by deadline. This book takes you to a new level where bad information can cause catastrophe. By the way, we got some drunks in there, and we've got some drug users and some really fine people. And nobody like you, though, because they tell me you have very high standards.
Yeah, sure.
And by the way, does Radio Susie really watch that kind of stuff on television?
Oh, no, she's too old. Oh, wait, did she just do something? No, but let me tell you what, I'm listening very close to you. Let me tell you what I would love to see this book become. And when I say become, everything that you're saying isn't necessarily, it's not fiction. These things go on. And there's no oversight committee. There's no consequence. There's nothing that says you can't say this, quote unquote, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, whatever that means today. It's got a completely definition of what it meant 20, 30 years ago. And if people will open their eyes, and maybe, just maybe, we can create some kind of a guideline whereby there is consequence if these things go on and get it stopped.
The majority of local newsrooms in the country have decent ethical standards. There's a vocal minority that really doesn't care. So basically, as I said before, it's more important to be first and possibly wrong than second and right. And I'll tell you right now, I've been involved in a lot of news over my career. I would rather be second and right than first and wrong any day of the week. The effort to be first, the effort to have exclusives, often creates misinformation. To give you an example, by the way, even on the morning of 9/11, which was one of the most, if not for the modern generation, the most traumatic day ever, one of the networks in this country went on the air with bad information, okay? And it was bad enough that we had to deal with that, and I'm not going to get into it, but somebody telling us that something happened that didn't really happen, and it was much worse than what we thought. So I think that you know, I know the people at NBC and CBS and ABC and all the people at the cable networks, and they really try hard to maintain a standard. Local news is different. Sometimes rogues are left in control. And by the way, sometimes major companies cut back so badly on their staffs that journalism gives way to total waste, and that truth becomes a victim, and that cowchips take over for truth.
You know, by the way, years ago, Larry, I wrote probably 25 years ago or so. I was in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was with KFAR Radio, and I started riding with the local police. And I felt something, and it was very interesting, that I could feel the euphoria starting to happen with, we'd go out one night, nothing would happen. I couldn't wait for something to happen so I can go back and report it. And That lasted for about 3 or 4 days, and then when I realized what was going on with me, I put a stop on it, because there is something that captivates you, and if you're not very careful, it can control you.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, there's nothing more exciting for a young reporter to travel with a police. And first of all, anybody, I would recommend any would-be journalist do that as much as they can, because you do learn, you do get into another person's world. You can be affected by it, but it's also interesting to see what people do to put their lives on the line every day and what they have to put up with. And I always felt that was a great example. But when you get into someone's world, whether it's the world of lawyers or politicians or broadcasting, for that matter, you tend to sort of admire those people. And sometimes it makes you a little more jaded. I've always admired cops just because I like cops. And I like what they do. And I know there's some good ones and bad ones, but most of them are good. I think I would hope that our business was as ethical as police and law enforcement people are in this world.
Yeah. By the way, Larry, I've only said no once to the cops, and it was they wanted me to do a show, and I said, guys, I don't think so. It was called Drop a Dime on Your Dealer, and what would happen?
Oh, God. Now, where are you based out of, Michael?
Wait, everybody in town, if there was anything going on, they'd call in the radio station. We'd call the squad cars. They'd go out and bust them. And we had a big window that you could see through, and I thought, I don't think so.
How about that?
That was the only time I ever said no to it. But it happens. And by the way, you get involved in things that most people would have no idea what to do with. I remember, I'll just make this quick. I remember once I'm sitting behind my desk, a guy called up. He was a cab driver for a local cab company, had murdered the owner of the cab driver that were in the building that we were in. He called me up and he said, this is nuts. You had a psychic on the show. This is wrong for me. How do I get all the psychic? And I said, didn't you just get arrested for murder? He said, yeah, but we get to make a phone call. From that, Larry, I called. I know. I called the chief of police. We got a hold of the mayor, and then I got arrested for 3 days. I got put with the prisoners right there. And they came up, put the cuffs on me. I wanted to see what it was like, and I spent a couple of days in jail. And I will never forget that as long as I live. When it came out, I reported on it. But what an experience that was, because I was dressed down in the blues just like the guys were.
How about that? Well, I wouldn't want to spend 2 hours in jail.
Yeah. We're starting to run out of time. Now, let me ask you this. Larry Kane, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, LarryKane.com. You'll find analysis and commentary there, but everything you need to know about this book, it's called Death by Deadline. It's doing very well on the digital platform, and in a couple of months we'll have it out in a print form because some people have asked for that. And it's a story I promise you you'll never forget.
Hey, by the way, Larry, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. I'm listening to what you're saying. I want the book.
Okay.
Good night.
Take care, Michael.
Mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Comer with us. He is the co-author of Start With Humility, Lessons from America's Quiet CEOs on How to Build Trust and Inspire Followers. And he's a consulting partner for the Hays Group International. His concentration is in the areas of organizational development, leadership development, and training development, and very important, delivery. He's got 25 years of consulting experience, and he's here with us tonight. Mike, hi, welcome to the show.
Great. It's a pleasure to be here, Michael.
Oh, Mike, thank you so much for being here. Now, today, I love the title in and of itself, Start With Humility, There are so many people that let their egos run them in business. They kill their bottom line. They kill the connection, the communication with the employees, and they don't know why they're not doing as well as they should.
I think that's the bottom line of what we were trying to say, Michael. And it's interesting, as we looked at businesses and leaders who we considered very successful from a number of different priorities, we found that one of the things that they all had in common was a strong will, but also a strong will with humility as well, and bringing those two together.
Now, by the way, when we deal with leaders, and it's an interesting word, I know you've coached groups of leaders before, what is it that makes a leader? This is not something innate to somebody jumps up and says, I'm a leader, and that's the end of it. A leader, there's an acquired skill behind it also. What's the ingredients that when you spot somebody, you know that they have the potential, there's the word, the potential to lead?
Oh, that's a very good question. And as you know, leadership is so broad. I mean, there's a variety of different ways of looking at leadership. One of the ways that I've learned just working with and with leaders over time is a key word that I consider influence. And even though you may not have a specific title, part of the idea is as you influence others, I think you do bring leadership. Two of the key words that we found in our research for doing this book when it comes to leadership, though, were trust and inspiration, meaning people may manage people, but when it really comes to leading, we found that people who say, I trust my leader and my leader inspires me to do more, to be more. It reminds me of a quote that John Quincy Adams said, if your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you're a leader.
Yeah, yeah. To take people beyond what they thought was possible themselves by themselves. And the other thing I think is extremely important, that in your press release, it's got, you know, train your brain, you know, the model for leaders at all levels. There are personalities. There are different personalities, and we relate differently. And for the most part, if you are a leader and you're in that position and you don't grasp the fact that saying something to four different people, they're going to hear four different things unless you can tie into their personality traits and allow them to recognize what it is that they're hearing out of what you say.
Oh, and it seems very common sense to us, doesn't it? But at the same time, you'd be absolutely surprised, people in multiple organizations at very high levels, so to speak, who don't realize how important it is to tailor to that audience.
No, absolutely. And the audience can be one person. How critical it would be for a CEO, CFO, COO, et cetera, to deal with that person that's under them, and that person that's under them doesn't understand what it is that supervisor, that owner wants, and the message goes down to, trickles down to people below them. And it affects the way the business is run. And at the end of the day, when they sit down and they say, why didn't you do this? Do what? You know, I told you, you told me what. And that's a killer in and of itself.
Yeah, I see it all the time. And we work in almost a different organization every week of the year. And it's some of the same common problems. The interesting thing that we found out, though, in the last 30 years of our small company, the Hays Group, being in business, is one of the characteristics of leadership, as we talked about, was the effective communication, the be able to vision, to be able to inspire others and for others to trust. But the part that you don't hear a whole lot about when you're discussing leadership in business or outside of business is this whole idea of humility. And usually people don't associate the idea of humility with leadership.
No, absolutely. I think what I hear within the context of the word humility is to allow other people to be human, allow other people's thoughts, feelings, ideas to be part and parcel of the decisions that are made to move you in the direction that you're going to go.
Well, it's very interesting because if you look at the root word of that word, humility, it comes from the Greek word meaning close to the ground. And it is amazing how often we look at leadership, whether they are political or whether they are in business, and we say, I really like that guy because he or she is very down to earth. And that's one of these concepts of humanness, as you just said, Michael. It's a great word to describe this, is keeping in mind as a leader, regardless of your experience and background and title, is that you are a human just like everyone else who's working with you and around you and for you.
Now, by the way, if I was a CEO of a major organization or in some kind of a major management capacity, what I would do in front of my office on the door before anybody walked in, I would have a big sign. And, Mike, that sign would say, is it a question or an accusation? And I think that in and of itself causes so many problems in the lack of communication in businesses. You ask a question. All you want is the answer. But the way they'll take it is you're accusing them of being less or not doing the job, et cetera. And I think that question alone can make all the difference in the world in so much of the relationship and the communication that goes on in any size business at any level. Is it a question or an accusation?
And our, you know, another piece that adds to that, Michael, is the assumptions that people make when, in fact, they assume it's an accusation in many cases. I think we jump to that pretty quickly sometimes as human beings as well.
Yeah, I think one of the major things that we're looking at today, Mike, also, is there's so much brain chemistry going on in the study of it and how it affects businesses, because that is it a question or an accusation, in essence, that we don't even recognize it, but we're ready to defense about anything, and it's a chemical reaction, we're not even aware of it, and it can cause problems. So that's where is it a question or is it an accusation comes from. If it's a question, you're not defending. If you experience it as an accusation in any way, shape, or form, unconsciously, the problems start. But if you think about it ahead of time, you're good.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Michael, that you talk about the brain chemistry, because one of the things we talk about in the book is, can you really change behaviors? So, for example, we talk about specific behaviors that humble leaders do. And it's very simple things. It's not rocket science. It's using the team. It's using we and the words that you use. It's allowing yourself to look out for others, not just yourself. It's some basic things, but we list 60 different behaviors that we observed. But when it comes back to the brain function that you were mentioning earlier, and you mentioned that phrase, train the brain, one of the questions that we set out to ask is this idea of humility, and the way we define it here is people who are very assertive, but assertive not for themselves, for the organization. Is it something that's innate, or is it something people can learn? And what we found is, for some people, it becomes easier than others, but there are specific behaviors that people can train their brain to do that will make them more effective when they're building trust with other people. And that was really the research that my co-author, Merwin Hayes, and I did in this book, Start With Humility, was how to literally train your brain to do some of those behaviors that will make you more effective.
No, absolutely, and it is training in any way anybody looks at it. You grow up, you learn certain patterns, you learn certain behaviors, you learn certain ways to respond. The operative word there, Mike, was learn. And if you can learn, you can unlearn, and you can relearn if you choose to do so. And once you look at something different, it sets an entirely different chemical makeup and process in the brain.
And it's very interesting, too, Michael, because one way that you learn and unlearn behaviors is through a loop of practice, feedback, meaning if it doesn't come natural to me, some of these behaviors that should make me more effective, then I need to be able to literally practice them. Let me give you a quick example. We often talk to people about the importance of listening. So it's not just what you're saying, but are you really listening to the other person? And folks who come through the assessments that we do and the coaching that we do in our firm will often say something like, oh, I read your book and I want to be a better listener. Well, that sounds good, but how do you make that specific? How does that mean you're not going to interrupt people, you're going to maintain good eye contact, you're going to look up from that BlackBerry and maintain looking them in the eye? You're going to really write down notes of what they're saying. What specifically can you do? And then what we've learned, to make that a habit, you have to be able not only to practice the specifics, but get feedback. Someone who knows you well, who can say, you know, you're working on listening, but I noticed you never looked up from your computer when I walked into your office. those are small things, but it's very interesting. They send a message to people who you're working for and with in terms of your leadership and your connection at the human relationship level.
Realistically, as someone working for someone, Mike, the one thing that people that we move for, we search for, we'll buy for, we'll die for, is acceptance. And it's as simple as you just said it, looking up from your computer. If you feel accepted, you in the general sense of the word, you're part of something. And as long as you're part of something, you're going to give your all, because that gives you this very important word, the I word. It gives you identity.
It does. I think that's a great way to say it. And I think that gets to the essence of some of the things that we've discovered when we've worked with leaders around the world in multiple different organizations. It's interesting, Michael, because I was thinking about this interview in my office. There was a Time magazine from 2 weeks ago, and on the front cover it said, "Sex, Lies, and Arrogance, What Makes Powerful Men Behave So Badly," with some pictures of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the cover and Dominic Strauss-Kahn. And then just 2 days ago, I read an article in USA Today that talked about people like Anthony Weiner and Edwards, the presidential candidate.
Yeah, right, sure.
And a
sure,
number
John
of others. And it's very interesting because both articles came down to this one word, in my opinion, and it was used in both articles, excessive ego. Not ego, which can be good in many cases, and confidence,
sure,
but excessive ego. And that's where that humbleness and those humble behaviors tie in.
Yeah, it's called who controls who. You know, we all have an ego. I mean, there's no question about that. But does your ego control, rhetorically, does your ego control you? Do you control the ego? And sometimes the best gift you can give to someone is to be quiet and listen to them. Well, let me take it back. Be quiet and hear them. There's a bridge between listening and hearing. And I think it's that bridge in and of itself that's the magic when you're trying to connect.
And these things seem very simple, don't they? And very common sense. But you'll be surprised at how many leaders struggle with things like we're talking about.
Oh, sure. But by the way, Mike, it took me 40-some-odd years to learn that. And I didn't learn it until I was in my 20s or something, whatever, 110 years ago. But you know what? Yeah, it's like the old story about the bridge that's going to go, and when the bridge goes, the entire town's going to get flooded, and there's going to be billions of dollars of disaster. So they call the engineer who knows, and he walks up, and he's there at the dam, and he looks at the equipment, and he reaches up, and he hits a button, and everything stops. Everybody's saved. So later on, he sends him a bill for $100,000. He says, what's the bill? $100,000. How long were you there? He said, about 10 seconds. He says, you're going to charge me $100,000 for 10 seconds? No. It's $20.35 for the 10 seconds. The rest of it is all the years it took me to know which one to hit.
That's true, isn't it? And
yeah,
you know, it's interesting because what we found when we studied some of these, what we call humble leaders, is there's a word that ties into that story you just used, Michael, and that is this ability of being teachable and open-mindedness, meaning even though someone may have X number of years of experience and may have done a lot of things, they're still teachable and they're continuing to learn. And by the way, not only are they learning from people around them or peers, but some of the younger people coming into the organization. We looked at a number of different leaders, and we said, who would exemplify this aggressiveness, but who's also very humble and displays these humble behaviors, close to the ground, down to earth? And we talked to a number of people that names you'd recognize, like Howard Schultz at Starbucks, and Roger Enrico at DreamWorks, and the chairman of Macy's, and Yum Brands, and Brenda Barnes at Sara Lee. And we asked them who would display that, and they all gave us some of the same names. And we ended up looking at some of those people and interviewing them. They were all very reluctant to be interviewed for this book because that's not who they are. They're not looking for publicity. But we found five what we call leaders who start with humility, and we tell their story in the book. And then we asked them, what are three things that you've learned in your years of experience? And these are very experienced people. The ex-president of PepsiCo, General Frederick Franks. Many people know the name Tommy Franks, but this is Frederick Franks, a behind-the-scenes general, one point commanded 124,000 people. The president of the largest zipper company in the world. If you have a zipper on your clothing, it says YKK. And we looked at what those guys are learning, and we found some of the basic things that you and I have been talking about around communication, around remembering people's names and knowing the importance, as you said, of the acceptance. And that's what we tried to put into this book, is what some of those lessons learned from that group was.
No, absolutely. And I think it's the transition from, quote, well, I don't mean us, Mike, but from me to you, quote unquote, when somebody can step outside of themselves. And really what the key is about those people that you're trying to reach, teach, the sell, market, whatever the case may be. And the only thing that they hear, and this is just what human nature is not what you say, it's what they hear inside what you say is what's going to benefit them, what's going to be there for them. And it's like saying this, if I say to you, what is your book about? And you would say to me, it's about humility, it's about leadership. And then I would say to you, no, ask me what your book is about. I've been listening very closely. And my answer to you would be, if you say to me, Michael, what's your book about? My answer to you is going to be you. And that's really what it is. They have to see themselves within the context of what's written, what's said, and what's felt.
And how it can help them, I think so, too.
Yes.
And
that was absolutely.
Really the intent of how we ended up writing this is because we found a number of people who are leaders in the Boy Scouts, who are leaders in their local church, who are people in the community, as well as people in Fortune 100 companies, new supervisors, people who have been leading people for years, all the way up to the CEO position, who struggle with some of these things. And what we really wanted to do is the you part, but also how can this help you? And so that's how we ended up interviewing the people. And the last part of our book is really a workbook. It's where it asks, are you doing these behaviors? And here's some very specific. We end up with 66 coaching tips, very specific things that people can do that we think will make them more effective, not just as a leader, but as a leader who is aggressive, not for themselves, but for others.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael Comer, we're running out of time. A website where we can find you and the book.
The easiest way to find out about the book is just www.startwithhumility.com. And it'll take you to the rest of the information, and it'll talk to you about the book and give you some additional information there. www.startwithhumility.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Fabulous places we're longing to see.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are familiar. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we're going to bring the best, brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get together. Let's do it together. Get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Dr. Srini Pillay with us, MD. He's the author of Your Brain in Business, The Neurosciences of Great Leaders. He's a renowned psychiatrist, certified master, executive coach, and the author of Your Brain in Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. As a teacher, trainer, and executive coach, he's worked with a variety of partners and clients, including Mobius Executive Leadership, the Forum Corporation, the World Bank, and the list goes on. And let's say, Srini, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, we get into brain sciences today, neurosciences. We've heard so much about it, and it seems to be becoming an integral part of our lives, whether it's business, whether it's social, whatever the case may be. It seems as though we're beginning to learn that our brain has a tremendous effect on the outcome of almost everything we do 24 hours a day.
It really does. You know, and I think initially people thought of it as an academic discipline, but the reality is that people are often making decisions because of things that are going on in their brains. And I think because we realize that some of our decisions are conscious and others are not, trying to understand how the brain works can really make a big difference.
So the average person in business, obviously, there are disappointments every day, there are shocks every day, there's that nervousness, the anticipation of the decision that's going to be made. And with each one of these experiences, the brain also is working. Is the brain protecting us? Is the brain moving us forward, holding us back? How do we start to control all of the mechanisms of that brain that's in there that really causes what we do and how we are?
Well, you know, there are a number of different ways in which we can do this. I think you make an absolutely accurate point, which is that our everyday anxieties, our causes for concern all register in the brain. And the fear center of the brain is called the amygdala. And when people are afraid, they can either be consciously afraid or they can be unconsciously afraid, meaning you may actually be having anxiety going on in your brain without knowing it. And so what we know from our experiments in science is that when conscious fear affects the brain, it activates the amygdala or the fear center of the brain. And when unconscious fear activates the brain, it still activates the amygdala, meaning if you ask people, what have you seen, when we show them a frightening picture or threatening picture, they say that they've seen nothing, but when we look in the brain, we actually see that the amygdala is activating. And this part of the brain is so sensitive to fear that even in people who have a certain kind of blindness known as cortical blindness, for all intents and purposes they cannot see, if we present a fearful or threatening picture to them, the amygdala will still activate, indicating that the fear center of the brain really does activate to fear, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And in decision making in businesses, this is actually particularly important because the fear center of the brain connects to the thinking center of the brain. And when you get ripples going through the fear center of the brain, they actually spread to the thinking center of the brain and can disrupt this. Now, this usually works in a U-shaped curve in the sense that initially, the anxiety can actually be organizing. It can help you focus. It can help you concentrate. But at a particular point, you start to have diminishing returns. And what we need to do when we're thinking about brain science and business is to target those parts of the brain that can help us reduce anxiety. And what we do in order to do this is to target the frontal lobe where this thinking occurs that is connected to the anxiety center. And we can also target the actual anxiety center itself. And if you'd like me to go into some of the methods with which we target the frontal lobe, I'd be happy to do that.
No, absolutely. I would love to hear it. Go ahead.
So yes. There are a number of different methods that we use to target the frontal lobe. One of the most powerful methods is reframing. You know, you take a particular situation and you look at it another way. Now, a lot of people might say, well, you know, what difference does that make? You're still looking at the same situation. But what they don't recognize is that when you reframe a situation effectively, it actually changes your brain activation in the frontal lobe, and it changes the activation in the amygdala and can improve thinking with regard to decision-making. So if you take a simple decision like, you know, if a person's in a business and a person's feeling like they've gone through a series of negative occurrences, they've lost money through the last few sales, they're trying to figure out how to recover, there may be some people who are focusing on the losses, whereas other people reframe this and say, I've had these losses, but how do I focus on solutions?
And that simple reframing can actually change the activation in the brain. The
mnemonic that I
often use to help people think about this is a mnemonic I call Safe Frame, which is essentially resolving existing conflicts so that you can understand what's going on, reassessing the situation, refocusing, reengaging, and reframing. And essentially, all of those ways are ways of changing the activation in the frontal lobe. But there's also a relatively simple way of accessing the amygdala or the fear center of the brain in high-stress situations. And here what one can do is, rather than overanalyze, because, you know, a lot of times in stressful situations, people are always analyzing and asking why and how did this happen and how do I deal with this. That is helpful up to a particular point. But if you're looking for an effective timeout, if you're looking for a way in which you can reach that fear center directly and decrease its activation, you can do what we call emotional introspection, which is really just a big word for saying mindfulness. And what this means is that we can place our attention on where we feel the anxiety, whether we feel it in our chests or our stomachs. You simply place your attention there without any kind of judgment or analysis. And if you're not feeling the anxiety in a particular part of your body, you can actually just place your attention on your breath. And doing this just for a few minutes will change the activation in your amygdala. In fact, studies have shown that the fear center of the brain will actually decrease its activation if you simply do this without asking any questions or having any judgment.
Okay, Sabrina, let's take this a little step farther and let's make it a little more simple. So the difference between focus on the loss or focus on the gain, if I focus on the gain, I'm going to release endorphins, I'm going to release certain chemicals. If I focus on the loss, I'm going to release certain chemicals. Based on the chemicals I released from that thought, that picture, that whatever creates the image releases the chemical, it's the activating factor, will cause me to think and feel. So if when you're saying when you refocus, what it does, it sends out a different chemical for a different reaction. If I'm upset, if I'm depressed and I decide to smile, if I smile, I'm going to release endorphins. Endorphins is in turn will make me feel good. It'll calm me down. So in essence, if we understand this based on what's going on, if we do the right action will open up the pathway to the brain to get the result we want.
That's a great way of reframing what I just said.
Yeah. Okay, so in essence, that's really what we're dealing with is if we understand ourselves and understand the dynamic of the brain and what occurs, my goodness, you could control everything that's going on. You wouldn't have to go through the panic and the pressure.
Absolutely. So the brain that is constantly looking out for danger and that is seeking out threat to try to see what is wrong, that particular brain has all of its attention dedicated to negative things. So if you have 10 units of attention, for example, if 7 of those units are taken up looking for negative things, you only have 3 units left for problem solving. So a lot of people are unfair to themselves when they allow their minds to simply be focused on the negative things. If you release your attention from some of those things, and again, this is not an overnight thing. It's something that often requires a lot of practice. Once you learn how to practice this, you can learn how to refocus your attention on what is positive and thereby find more solutions.
Okay, so you said it earlier, I'm just going to repeat it. So if I'm in a business situation and I feel myself extremely stressed, if I could just walk away for a few minutes, quote unquote, take the time out, take a couple of deep breaths, get myself mindful, center myself, and allow the mechanics of my own body to come into play to be able to get me what I want, it's just that simple. The dynamic that occurs is not that simple, but just the process to get there is.
Exactly, because what you have to remind yourself at that point is to change your focus from focusing on the problems to focusing on the solution.
Yeah. Okay, which in essence, that sets up a completely different chain of events.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. And now where did you become aware of this? Where was it? And I know that neuroscience is in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years is really starting to take advances. Most professionals are starting to realize that there's something beyond a smile or beyond a frown and what occurs and causes you to do and be what you are. But where was it that scientists, that's provable part of our world, has started to take a look at this and the medical profession is looking at it and saying there's more to what people come in to us to see than meets the eye here?
Well, there are a lot of different contexts in which scientists look at this. They look at it all the way from laboratory studies in animals to the actual lab. In terms of my own life, I had studied brain imaging research for the past 17 years. And so what I did was I worked in a brain imaging laboratory at McLean Hospital, which is Harvard's largest psychiatric hospital. And what we did was essentially ask people to lie in brain imaging scanners while we offered them different stimuli to see how this would change what was going on in their brains. And by looking at what was going on in their brains, we were able to tell what fear would do to the brain or what changing their attention would do to the brain. And this kind of research is not just done at Harvard. It's done in a lot of different centers throughout the country in labs. And the methodology is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what that is that we observe changes in brain blood flow when we expose a person to different stimuli.
Now, we have known about the fight-or-flight mechanism for years and years and years and years and years. I don't really think that people have put practical application to the end result of what we're dealing with here. Because the, you know, that primitive area of mind, if you're in a relationship and somebody looks at you in a certain way, and that image goes to the brain and it's going to move back to a recognizable experience that you had in the past, causing that emotion for today. And I think it's all the same thing. Today, we're really starting to take a look at it and measuring it as it happens and saying, okay, this is the dynamic that occurs. I use that word 1,000 times. This is the dynamic that occurs when you're faced with something. But we are always protecting ourselves. If we don't understand it, if it's not familiar to us, if we don't feel confident within the circumstance that we're in, it's that protection mechanism that comes up. And most people give examples of exaggerated. It happens every day to almost everybody on this planet in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. You know, it's really so interesting to understand. I think for me, the beauty of this whole field is that we're now at a point where we can begin to apply some of this knowledge. And even how we talk to ourselves at times of stress is actually pretty important. You know, there was a recent study that was done that showed that when you give yourself self-instructions like do not drop the wine on the white couch, or sure, do not do this thing, or do not do this forbidden thing, the brain under stress is much more likely to do the exact opposite of what you're telling it. And I think that's another example of how neuroscience and psychological research has helped us understand in that particular instance that when you're framing an instruction to yourself under stress, frame it in the positive rather than the negative. Because when you frame it in the negative, under stress, the conscious brain is not able to actually interpret that. And what ends up happening is you end up doing the exact opposite of what you want.
Well, also, it comes unconscious. You said that early on. Was it Damasio around 1992, 94 something, who created the hypothesis of the somatic marker? And it's that somatic marker that's going to cause something, and it's such an unconscious activation of a memory that you're not even thinking about it. That's that emotional trigger, that tag, that causes a reaction within you, and most of us don't put it together with what's going on at the time, and the emotions that we're having don't make sense. But it could have been something that happened in the past that it was an unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience. Triggers everything that you're talking about, and it's having the control of that in and of itself. What a difference that would make in a person's life when they begin to realize what's occurring and why they're experiencing what they're experiencing, and with a simple breath and get mindful, get yourself centered, you can change the entire circumstance.
Absolutely. You know, the somatic marker hypothesis is really a very powerful hypothesis because it helps us understand that when you have an event that occurs that stimulates an old memory, part of the reason that happens is because that event gets registered in your brain as an electrical current, and that current will often travel to stimulate some kind of matching event that occurred in the past. And so the somatic marker hypothesis helps us understand, as you pointed out, that there are a lot of unconscious phenomena that can actually change the way in which we react to circumstances, and what's happening may not even be about what's actually happening, but about what's happened in the past.
No question. Let me give you a quick story with that, and we're starting to run out of time. I was 8 years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror. I'm playing cowboys. I've got my hat on, my cap guns. I'm screaming. I'm yelling. My dad walked in, and he laughed at me, shut me right off. And as an 8-year old, I played in front of the mirror again, but that was the last time I did it out loud. As an adult, I understand it. I've got a handle on it. I know what it was. But as a teenager, you didn't dare talk down to me. You didn't laugh at me. unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience. I'm getting into an argument with somebody or a fight with somebody because of something that happened in the past had nothing to do with what's going on now. It was something familiar. It activated that marker, and now I'm going full-blown. And I think that in and of itself is a way people can begin to understand how they respond and react to things that happened in the past that they're not consciously aware of. And with that, we're starting to run out of time. Srini, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. The website I'd recommend is neurobusinessgroup.com. It's N-E-U-R-O, and then the word business, all one word, group.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Srini Pillai, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Again, the book is Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders. Hey, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Try because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly.
Each night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Diets fail. They leave us hungry. They leave us lethargic. They leave us miserable. And after a cycle of yo-yoing, and often we end up even heavier than we were when we started. Mark McDonald says that. He's the author of Body Confidence. Venice Nutrition three-step system that unlocks your body's full potential. And let us say, Mark, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think in today's world, if you walk through any supermarket, Mark, they should be grabbing what you have put to pen and what you've created here. I don't even understand how this advent of obesity has rocked this country. So let me start from scratch with you. Where was it that caught your eye about how to get rid of this problem?
You know, I've lived it. You know, when we look at the problem, why obesity is so rampant, is it comes back down to what we're being taught from the educational side. That
sure.
We're still focusing on calories in versus calories out. That we're set up on that you should cut your calories, you should burn more fuel than you're taking in, and then that's going to let you drop weight, but it doesn't allow you to actually reprogram your metabolism. And then once we start going back to what we were doing before, we put it all on plus some. You know, I was an athlete. Since I was 7 years old, ate whatever I wanted, used exercise to stay lean. When I finished playing soccer in college, kept eating poorly, stopped exercising, put on 60 pounds by just still eating poorly, and then I freaked out, and I did what a lot of us do. I went on a high-fat, high-protein, cut all my carbs out, cut my calories down, went back to exercising a lot, and in 4 months, dropped my 60 pounds, took my body to 4% body fat, and lived as a fitness model for 4 years, looking amazing, and feeling horrible. So I think the long story short of it, Michael, is that, you know, we're all looking for a way to look and feel our very best, but wherever we turn, we're still inundated with we need to exercise more, we need to eat less, and that philosophy and that concept does not work, and that's why I created the program.
By the way, Mark, you said something very interesting, and I caught that. It was looking good, I'll use my words, looking good, but feeling horrible. There's so many people that are going through that right now. What's that bridge? What is that certain something that seems to be missing in most of the diet and nutrition programs that we're seeing today?
Well, everything's based along calories in versus calories out, meaning you have to cut and you have to restrict. And this is the question I ask. When is a deficit ever a good thing? It's not good to go out and spend $10,000 on a credit card. Eventually you have to pay that back. Same thing when you look at cutting calories. When people start diets, I call it your tipping point. Weight's heavier than it's been before, energy's low, pants are too tight, and you just want to do anything. Your frustration is so high. You're most vulnerable. So you do the diet of the month. You cut everything. You drop the weight. You sacrifice. You don't eat the food you enjoy. You drop the weight, and you feel good for a moment. And then life starts to push back a bit. And everything you abandon starts working back in. So you're looking good, but you're not feeling good. Your energy starts to falter a little bit more, and that's what causes that yo-yo syndrome that all of us are familiar with.
Now, by the way, you mentioned a very interesting word. When you mentioned the word metabolism. Let's lay a base. People hear this word constantly. That doesn't necessarily mean, Mark, that they know what the word means and the effect it has on your overall health.
Your metabolism is the energy you burn on a daily basis. And the answer is through stabilizing your blood sugar. So imagine this. Imagine eating every 3 to 4 hours the right amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrates per meal and the right amount of calories. That's going to keep your body in an internal hormonal balance, and it will allow your metabolism to burn the most amount of body fat and energy and produce the most amount of energy for your body to work. So we're all born genetically with a particular rate that our body's going to process energy. It's kind of like a car where you have certain cars that can burn a lot more fuel than other cars. But the reality is that whatever your metabolism, whatever you feel you sit at in the sense of whether you feel like you can just look at food and gain weight or you feel like you can eat anything and never gain weight or you feel like you're somewhere in between, we can actually reprogram your metabolism, shift the mindset from cutting food to actually teaching you how to create internal hormonal balance through stabilizing your blood sugar, and then that sets your body up to reprogram your metabolism and achieve permanent results.
So when we're talking about body confidence, it's not my emotions, it's not my mindset, it's what my actual body does by itself. The body in and of itself has confidence within itself because you're feeding it the right nutrients, et cetera, to be able to function the way it's supposed to function, which in turn will affect the emotions.
Yeah, it's all body confidence to me is really looking and feeling your very best. You know, I think that's, you know, anyone can lose weight. So you can look good, but can you feel good? And then a lot of times people think they're feeling good, but can they feel better? So physically, you can never look and feel your best if you don't create internal hormonal balance, if you don't understand and shift the mindset from using deprivation or calorie restriction as your foundation or exercise as your foundation to really understanding to use nutrition as your foundation through stabilizing your blood sugar, then that's going to give you the power to actually address the emotional stuff, you know, the attachments to food, you know, getting very clear on what your health is. And that's really why I created a 3-step system to help people understand how to create a foundation where they can work from to really take their body to another level.
Okay, Mark, I want to go back to where I was because I was reading this and the thought struck me as I began to look deeper into this. There's two entities we're dealing with here, and stop me if I'm wrong because I'm not a clinician. I'm just listening very closely to what you have to say here. You've got you, Mark. You've got Mark McDonald, the person's the essence of that causes you to be and do who you are. Then the other entity is you got Mark, you got your body. Your body functions in a certain way. You feed it the right thing, your body works with you. You don't feed it the right thing, your body works against you, which affects you who Mark is. And I really believe body confidence is allowing the body to have its own confidence in itself to be able to fully function the way that it was set out to function, as opposed to us putting all the roadblocks and the challenges and all the things that we shouldn't be eating. So I'm really hearing, and again, stop me if I'm wrong, you got two entities to deal with, yourself, your emotions, and then the body in and of itself, because the body needs certain things. It needs that hormonal balance, that homeostasis, to be able to truly function, because if the body's not feeling good, neither are you and I.
Michael, you are spot on, and I love how you laid that out. And that's the point, that so many times we're first addressing the emotional response without addressing the physiological response. And you're so right that if you can stabilize your blood sugar and actually create internal hormonal balance, then that empowers you to actually address the emotional response. Spot on.
Yeah, and I know so many people who have gone to, even gone through operations, gone through the gastric bypasses, the stuff, they do it for a certain period of time. And Mark, within a year or 2 years, they've got the weight back. And I've heard some statistics where people actually commit suicide. So there also has to be that balance. And you're right, I've seen people who look absolutely wonderful, but if you sit down with them, they don't feel so good. And I think it's the combination of the two. And even in the tagline, the three-step system that unlocks your body's full potential. It is potential, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the body's the most amazing thing. And I think that when you talk about gastric bypass and why people put the weight back on after, it's because they don't understand. It's an education. As a society right now, the core root of it is no one's really ready to spend the time, well, many people are, but many people are not, are ready to spend the time becoming educated about their body. When we think of a baby feeds every 3 to 4 hours. They have breast milk, which is protein, fat, carbohydrates. They stop eating when they're satisfied. They eat again when they're hungry. From the first breath we take, that's how our body's meant to physiologically be fed, because it stabilizes our body hormonally, balances our blood sugar. And then that allows us to be in homeostasis. Come that second year of life, a baby has enough stored reserve so they can abandon that feeding process. You go to your doctor. I mean, my son, you know, first year of life, everything was about his feeding. Second year of life, you know, just do what your parents are doing. Does he fit the height-weight chart? But see, that's not how the body's meant to be fed, and you were spot on. You have two choices. Feed your body the way it's meant to be, and your body will be working for you, and you'll continue moving forward, or you don't, and your body has to step in. And whenever it steps in, there's a cost, and that cost is typically lower energy, burning muscle mass, and storing fat.
Now, by the way, when there's something where we've got about a couple, 3 minutes left, but one thing I want to bring up that I think is critically important. When we think about losing weight, and this is within your press release, this hit me very strong here, that most people, when you talk about losing weight, you want to lose 40, 50, 60, 30 pounds. But I would say that the bulk of everybody that really wants to lose weight, where they get stuck, is those people who just want to lose 10 pounds. And that, yes, in and of itself is so tough for so many people.
It is, and it comes back down to utilizing nutrition, finding your nutrition rhythm and your exercise rhythm. So when I teach people and I educate people, it's not about doing more. It's about becoming better at what you do. So the first step is you must stabilize your blood sugar. Protein, fat, carbohydrates in the right breakdowns, the right meal intervals, right calories. That's going to put your body in balance. That's going to force your body to release its stored fat. Then we optimize your exercise, and all of it's laid out in the book Body Confidence. And we optimize your exercise, and that fat you're releasing through stabilizing your blood sugar then gets burned up in your muscle for energy, and that's how you lose the last 10 pounds. That's how you take your body to another level, and that's how you permanently reprogram your set point or your internal metabolism.
Now, by the way, I have the book in front of me, and there's a lot of before and after pictures on the back of the book, etc. And you can look at the look on the people's faces who dropped the weight. It's more than just losing the weight. It's almost a return of or a creation of the first time they've ever had dignity in their entire life. You ask a lot of people who are overweight if they're happy. They may lie to you in front, but when you get underneath it, they're not happy. They didn't get the job they wanted because they were afraid to walk in and apply. They didn't get the boyfriend, the girlfriend they wanted because they were afraid to ask the question, and so on and so forth. And socially, they've been pushed aside for the most part. So it's not just losing weight. It's about the recreation or the creation of an entire lifestyle.
Exactly. The majority of people right now, we set the bar so low that people reach to be average. See, I want us to reach to be the best that we can be, and I think people want that. When you go through the book and you see all the success stories and the thousands that have done our program, the reality is that they just were looking for a better way and they didn't know where to go. And that's the thing, if we can really get our education in place and you can really learn how to feed your body optimally, exercise efficiently, you will take your body to another level. And what you get from it is everything. it takes you to a place where we all want. And that's really when we talk about the body confidence, it gives you confidence in every aspect of your life.
You know, I love that on page, I've memorized the book here, on page 10, Abby McDonald, there's a picture of the before and after with her. If you look at her face before, she looks like a very sweet woman, no question about it. But if you look at her face afterwards, there's not only sweetness, but there is an air of confidence in that face. There's the difference between the two. It moved into the different level.
Yeah, that was, and that's Abby's my wife, and that's the biggest thing when we look at what she went through. I mean, she was a core piece of how I created the sixth component, which we call the body confidence plan. She had a physical injury, saw her body deteriorate over a year, and we realized that it was just much more than just stabilizing your blood sugar. It was that actually creating balance with your sleep, nutrition, exercise, base supplementation, water, and stress. All six components gave her her balance back in her body, and in essence gave us our lives back.
You just really said it, gave you your life back. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website, or of course there's the website we can find you at and buy the book, sign up for the programs, and do what we need to do?
Website is Venice, like Venice Beach, California. That's where we started, VeniceNutrition.com. You can read all about the program. We have practices nationwide. We have an online software program. And then obviously the book is Body Confidence.
Wonderful. Hey, Mark McDonald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
It isn't what wrong is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous, faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we... Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are free. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dwayne McCauley coming up next.
Fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. Dwayne McCauley with us is the author of Death to Diabetes, How an Ex-Diabetic Beat Diabetes Despite a Blood Glucose Lever, glucose level of over 1,300. Local engineer on the brink of death, went into a diabetic coma at Rochester General Hospital with a blood sugar level of 1,337. That's more than 1,200 points above normal, and lived to tell about it. Dwayne McCauley was able to overcome severe hypoglycemia and also 2 blood clots, pneumonia, high cholesterol, 4 insulin shots a day. He used his engineering and his biochemistry background to repair his body and methodically and completely wean himself away off of the insulin and some of the other drugs that he was taking, and eventually to write the now acclaimed and top-selling book, Death to Diabetes. And let us say, Dwayne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Dwayne, when we think about this with diabetes and the effect that it's having on the population, here you got a guy who ends up with 1,337 with a blood sugar level, 1,200 points above normal, and you beat it. Was it a mindset? What was it when you found out everything you had to face? What were the first things that went through your head?
Very good question. I run workshops around the country, and everyone asks the same question. And the answer? My mother.
Yeah,
my
okay.
mother, my daughter, they basically they got on the plane and came up to take care of me. And my mother threw all the food in the kitchen. She threw out my pizza pies, the soda, the ice cream, everything. And she replaced it with raw food, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, spinach, the three vegetables that I hate, Michael. And my mother said, son, this is what we grew up on, you know, back home on the farm. And this is what you need to eat to get.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't...
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Dr. Daniel Siegel with us, MD. He's the co-author of The Healthy Mind Platter, 7 Daily Essential Mental Activities to Optimize Brain Matter and Create Well-Being. He's currently a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, where he's on the faculty of the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development and the co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center. And let's say, Dan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Oh, and by the way, when we really think about this, just the title in and of itself, The Healthy Mind Platter, 7 Daily Essential Mental Activities. We don't think about that, do we, Dan? We think about work out the body, work this out. But what about the brain? What about the mind? That's, I think, is so critical that it's that missing link that most people don't even think about.
It's so true. And, you know, the importance of, on a daily basis, working out your mind to keep your brain healthy is something we can all embrace. And so David Rock and I put together the Healthy Mind Platter to remind people, in fact, that there are things you can do to keep your mind, your brain, and even your relationships in optimal shape. So
now,
each of those 7 ingredients is a way to do that.
Now, realistically, when we do this for the average person, what's that first step? What's the first thing that we can do that the average person, that no matter what walk of life they're in, can actually take advantage of this?
Well, the first thing to do is, you know, when you wake up in the morning and realize you're facing a whole day in front of you, realize that there are things you can do intentionally to keep your brain healthy. One of them, for example, is making sure you get enough sleep. And a lot of people, especially teenagers, are not getting enough sleep these days. So honoring time to sleep, turning off all of our internet stuff and our digital screens, you know, before bedtime, so we can actually let our minds begin to rest, let our brains get ready to recuperate, is extremely important. So sleep, even as a starting point, is important when you're planning your day, even in the beginning. Say, okay, today I'm going to make sure I get enough sleep. And, you know, when you do this intentionally, people can actually create a proper kind of sleep hygiene, if you will, a way of getting yourself ready to enter that sleep state. Then, you know, after you've woken from a good sleep, once you've started doing this, the next thing to think about is actually physical exercise, what we call physical time. And it may be surprising to a lot of people, but actually moving your body around is extremely important for your brain. It keeps the way the brain continues to make new connections inside of itself alive and healthy. And people who exercise, if you can do it medically, in an aerobic way, if that's medically okay for you to do, really working up a sweat if you can, 20, 30 minutes a day, If you can do that, studies show your brain will continue to grow and function well. So physical time, in addition to sleep time, is also really important. And I can go through all of them, Michael, but basically, when you look at these seven ingredients, and we can go through each of them, you realize that if you wake up in the morning and say, how can I make sure that this day that I'm living today, I include each of these seven ingredients, you'll actually be doing things to keep your mind healthy and your brain growing in an optimal kind of way. It's a healthy mind platter for optimal brain matter. That's how we want to put it out there so people can remember, in fact, that each of us are empowered to keep ourselves healthy in this way.
And it's being mindful. It's that, you know, one of the talking points is focus time. And it's critical because most of us don't focus. We're an hour ahead, 10 minutes behind, and we get lost in whatever that now is. I think playtime is extremely important. And that doesn't mean you have to go out for 2 or 3 hours and do something. I think all day long. So sometimes I like to walk outside and grab a shovel and do something or mow a lawn. And that effectively can be playtime. It's getting your mind off of that focus time and just relaxing.
Well, that's exactly right. And just to stick with focus time for a moment, you know, with the kinds of things we're bombarded with these days, it's easy to get overwhelmed. For example, just get on the internet. It's this endless feeling that you could pursue all the different things on that forever and never feel completed. So with focus time, the idea is instead of multitasking and being thrown into a feeling of being overwhelmed, instead you can say, let me do one thing at a time. Let me try, let's say, to focus on reading a book or doing what I'm doing at work one thing at a time. Even if you're going to, let's say, play a musical instrument or, you know, listen to some music, even that, if you're really focusing deeply, what studies show is that parts of the brain that are necessary to keep the brain growing well are actually activated when you have the deep, close paying of attention. So focus time says don't multitask, have some time where you're clearly focusing in a very direct kind of way, and the state of the brain's activity will actually reinforce healthy brain growth. Now, you also mentioned, Michael, playtime. And so instead of just focusing all the time, we also have to give ourselves a break, whether it's mowing the lawn or going for a walk or just turning on some music and just dancing around. This is the idea, not like playing tennis or competing on a football team. Those are really important, too, but that's more like physical activity. This is where you're playing in a spontaneous, creative way that allows your brain to make new combinations where you're not just doing what someone's told you to do, or you're not carrying out just rules that are governed by, let's say, a game's way of being played. You're really trying things in new ways. So playfulness has everything to do with novelty. And the studies of the brain show that when you allow yourself to become immersed in new things, the brain grows in new ways. And so it's a way to really continue to keep the brain healthy and growing well. So that's we've got our focus time in there, play time. We've talked about sleep time and physical time. And those are four of the seven that really, if you think about just doing this every day, and what people have told us about is, you know, it gives you kind of a framework on how to live your life that's flexible, so it's not a prescription like someone's telling you exactly how to do it, but it gives you a kind of a framework where you say, okay, have I had playtime today? And you go, you know, I'm pretty down and out. I think I'm going to play around. And it really can help a person's day just totally change.
Oh, and let's take this a step farther. Each action that you're talking about, connecting physical time, play time, focus time, sleep time, each one of these actions creates a chemical reaction from that brain that's going to go to the proper place in the body to cause it to work effectively. So by intentionally moving through the areas that you're talking about, you're intentionally also creating the neural pathways for these chemicals to go through to cause our bodies to act in a good balanced harmony.
That's right. That's actually right. And that's the exciting thing about it is the way you focus your attention actually generates the kind of brain activity that we now know from research clearly shapes the connections in the brain. And so let's take, for example, the next one, which is time in. Time in is what you mentioned about mindfulness. This is the idea of actually reflecting on the internal world, of really being open to, let's say, sensations coming in, your what you hear, what you see, really focusing clearly on your sensory world, paying attention to images, feelings, and thoughts, and you can remember those words just by the word SIFT, S-I-F-T. Sensations is the S, images, the I, feelings, the F, T, thoughts. And so if you just kind of sift through your inner world, this is what time in means. And what all the research on being mindfully aware like that show is all that research data shows that you integrate the brain. You actually make the brain coordinate and balance its functioning so your emotions are more even keel. Your ability to be connected to other people, the social circuits of the brain, is really more robust. And even your ability to pay attention is improved. And amazingly, Michael, and I know if the science wasn't here, it would be wild for me to say this, but amazingly, studies show that when people do a time-in practice like this, their immune system improves. And even the parts of each cell that maintain the cell's life, they're called telomeres, an enzyme is increased when you do this kind of time-in practice that maintains those ends of the chromosome, so your cells actually live longer. And this kind of time in practice then can prolong your life, can make the quality and the longevity of your life increased. So this is not just opinion. This is from well-controlled scientific studies on how these time-in mindfulness practices actually improve physiological well-being, including how your brain functions.
So in effect, what we're saying here is to be in control, as opposed to allowing your body and your mind to control you. If you're in control of it, then you can dictate how you're going to feel about things and your attitude towards things, how you think, feel, and behave towards anything. So if you're in control and all of these processes are working, that's also one of the basic steps of anti-aging. You said it, you live longer, you feel better, and you know exactly what you're doing. Most people don't know this. And this is
well, that's exactly right, Michael. And, you know, here's one word that you hear is the phrase automatic pilot. You know, when your life is just on automatic pilot, you feel like you're kind of a passive passenger on this journey of life, and this happens, and that happens, this happens, that happens. You know, you're just kind of like a cork bobbing up and down on the sea. Instead, a time-in practice, and there's one in particular people can do called the Wheel of Awareness practice. You can just get it from my website for free, just download it and listen to it. What people have said is that when you do the Wheel of Awareness practice, if you picture an inner hub of this wheel and an outer rim, the hub represents being aware. The rim represents anything you can be aware of, let's say like a thought or a feeling or an image or something like that. When people do this Wheel of Awareness practice as an example of a time-in focus, what you do is you come to realize that awareness has a strength to it, and that while you may have certain feelings or thoughts that come up, they don't take you over. And then what you do is you become, you use the word in control, you can say you become out of automatic pilot, you become really intentional in the way you live. And while these feelings and thoughts may come and go and you can't control everything, they don't control you. That's the beautiful thing about this metaphor of a wheel. When the hub gets stronger in this time in practice, what happens is what before would take you over and feelings that would ruin your day, you can acknowledge the feeling, it's a point on the rim, and then you realize there are so many other points on that rim. You come back to this inner sanctuary, this inner strength of the hub, and then your life is different for that day. And then you practice this every day. It's a regular practice, just like you eat solid meals every day. This is the idea of a time in practice every day. Really, the studies show strengthens attention, emotion, the ability to be empathic, improves your immune system, your chromosomes, everything. So in this way, you really go from automatic pilot, where you're passive, to actually becoming the active author of your own life story. That's
within
everyone's grasp.
Yeah, and a great example of that on a practical level, Dan, is that every once in a while, it'll go beyond my ability to hold it together. I'm going to get upset. I'm going to get frustrated about something. In the basement, there is Barney the beat-up bag.
It's a
boxer's heavy-duty bag. So I know if I put the gloves on, I come down and I work out for 5-10 minutes, and I just work that bag, I'll work up a sweat, and it's done. But what I have done is I've intentionally change the chemical makeup of my brain and release the chemicals that will cause me to calm down and to feel good. So it's intentional.
That's absolutely right. And so rather than, let's say, the anger is building and building, and so, Michael, you're just, you know, a prisoner of the anger, you said, you know, the anger is there. I can't control it in the sense of just say, go away, anger, you don't exist. Instead, you say, okay, the anger is there. Now I'm going to actually do something intentionally to respect the anger. So you do it constructively instead of destructively. You punch the bag. And then you actually physiologically change your state because you're expressing the anger, and you're literally allowing your whole brain to accept what is and then move on. For many of us, what happens when we live on automatic is, let's say, anger takes us over. We don't do something intentionally to take care of it. We just are mad. We have anger. We say we shouldn't be angry. And, you know, when you say you shouldn't be something and you try to just bury it, it actually doesn't go away. And some people just try not to feel things. And there's no way to kind of selectively say, well, I think I won't feel, let's say, anger, without it actually affecting all your feelings, so then you don't feel joy and happiness. So there are people who just try to control everything and shut everything down. But instead, they should do exactly what you did. Intentionally say, this is a feeling that's going on. The most constructive thing I can do is really express it in a healthy kind of way. And then I move on. It's fantastic.
Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time now. Where can we buy the book at?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can do this. There's a book called Mindsight, which explores some deep ways which you can do time in practices. You can literally integrate your brain. That's one thing, and that you can buy anywhere, Amazon or, you know, any of your local booksellers. You can go to my website, drdansiegel.com, drdansiegel.com, and there you'll find a whole bunch of things, books, audio programs. You can get the Wheel of Awareness practice for free there. You can find the Healthy Mind Platter there. I think the idea here, and what David Rock and I really wanted to do in putting this together, is say, look, everyone can approach your life by realizing what's the daily intake for a healthy mind, and now we have it available to us. So, you know, the two times we didn't talk about are downtime, which is kind of hanging loose and just letting your mind unwind, and connecting time.
We're out of time, but I'm going to ask Susie to get back on the show. It's critical that we address this.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay, take her. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
And as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We're parting out as friends, your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.
Mm-hmm.